Muhammad, praise be upon him, I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum everyone. Welcome back to your home. This is Youth Station. I am Asma and I have here with me.
I'm Rita, and my pleasure to be here with you.
Of course, it's always a pleasure to be here and to share this table with you.
Thank you.
So, Rita, how are you doing?
It's going well. Thank you.
There are a lot of things that are ugly in this life.
Exactly. And
but they happen.
The topic of today is the story of, I don't know, tragedy.
Yeah. It's not a tragedy. Well, tragedies are beautiful, but these things, you know... I guess when something comes out of ignorance or, let's say, not being fully aware of the consequences of the acts
of what
that you
doing.
Do,
exactly.
It's not going to be called tragedy. It's going to be called a mistake of your life.
When it comes to a big disaster, that it is not the mistake of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody else's life.
Yeah, of course. See, Bita, we read so much of articles and we hear it even.
Yeah.
That because it has been something which is very common everywhere. Of course, in Muslim countries, it is less heard about. But in other countries in which religion does not have a main role and is not playing a great role in society, we could see a lot of that. The unwanted children that are going to be coming into this world. Yeah.
In, you know, young ages.
Yeah, in very young ages.
Even telling the name is somehow a burden on my shoulder, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's so sad and dramatic.
You just imagine a girl of 15 years old is going to face such a big responsibility.
And the problem is that there's responsibilities on her shoulder.
Of course.
Not the boy. Even sometimes, you know, that boy will run away.
Of course,
what
because that
do?
Boy, again, Bita, is too young.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
see,
they are not ready to.
When a girl is 15, she can understand as I'm now, this is my personal perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it based on a factual knowledge.
Yeah.
My perspective of girls is that they are years before their age, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they understand things deeply more than boys. I do not mean that all the boys are just like
no,
this.
I understand
I'm just saying
you.
That girls would get to maturity before the boys.
Yeah.
And a boy in the age of 15 is going to be immature, is going to be carefree, and is going to... If he actually is not going to understand what is going around him.
I understand you. And unfortunately, you know, these rates that we have, the statistics that we can see in... Every country, every kind of country, especially non-Islamic countries, because they just don't go through the rules of religion or ethical rules, you know. And I want to tell you a dramatic statistic, which really, you know, can be heartbroken.
Of course, yes.
From every 10 girls under 20 years old in the United States, 3 of them will go through this tragedy. I don't want to use this word, but yeah,
through
tragedy
this dilemma, of course.
Yeah, exactly, of unwanted children. Pregnancy.
And just imagine what would happen to the girl and also to the child,
baby,
to the poor baby that is going
and
to come into this world.
The point is the baby because most of these people will go and because, you know, they have some financial problems in their own hometowns, they cannot afford facilities for that baby and the baby will go to orphanage.
Of course,
and this is a disaster.
Yeah, this is so painful, of course. And just imagine if that poor child is a girl.
Yeah.
So now the society is considering her as an unwanted thing as well.
Exactly.
Because she's not going to have a father to back her up.
Even no mother, no family, nothing, no education, no facility. And what is this life? Let's keep all this grief here.
Yeah.
And go for a break. Then we're going to come back.
Of course, yes. Here's Youth Station. Bita and I are talking about something very much painful, but we have to talk about it because we need to share the understanding, the education, the whatever thing, the awareness, let's call it this way, is better, I guess. We have to have an awareness, and we have to teach our daughters and even the sons about these sort of things.
Yeah.
In countries that are not Islamic, well, the children will be together at a school. And just imagine, they spend half of their day with their classmates, and those classmates are of other genders, of course.
Also, there were a kind of a research in this issue in the United States, which told us when they make these kind of schools which were mixed genders apartheid, the function of the students developed.
Yeah.
And this is a beautiful fact, actually, because you can see that...
because there's no more of distractions, and it's very logical.
This is a big distraction for their age.
You know? Yeah, for their age.
And, you know, we cannot blame anyone for that, because this is the nature of human beings.
Yeah.
We have some needs in ourselves. We have some loss or something that, you know, there should be answered, and there is answer, but in an appropriate way, in an appropriate age. But unfortunately,
in a responsible way, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Ethical way.
Ethical way.
But, you know, when it comes to school, I don't know, even elementary school or something, it will become a disaster.
Yeah, it will become a disaster, specifically because there are kids and they do not have any vision of their future and their any perspective of what is going to happen to them in future.
They're not mature.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have an understanding of responsibility.
So maybe one of the ways that we could do in order to ignore these situations to happen is to think more about the educational environment.
I do agree with that. I think we have to share the information, I don't know, about this issue to all the people, especially teenagers at a school, from, I don't know, teachers, the other people at school, mm-hmm. and also family.
Yeah,
is
family.
One of the, I don't know, key points of this issue of education, about this matter.
So, you know, I always think about it as a mother who's mm-hmm. living in a non-Islamic country.
Yeah.
Should you teach your daughter to be more careful about her relationship with her classmates?
Of course. This is your responsibility, in my opinion. You have to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no should or something like that. There is have to.
Yeah.
There is an obligation here. Because no matter where you are, whether it is Islamic or it's not, still there exist some ethical issues, and still there is the nature of human beings.
You know why I say non-Islamic? Because in Islamic countries, like our country, Iran, well, the classes are separated from each
exactly.
other. So the girls and boys can sit in their own class and then study without thinking about other distractions.
But still, I think we need education even in that situation.
Yeah, even in that situation, because in the modern age, there's no way to control, you know, you cannot be always there for your children
technology
and support them everywhere. Yes, technology
to
is
everything.
Enough. Technology is taking all the terrible and making everything available for all the children.
And also, I think this is one of the main root problems in this issue, that because technology and virtual world, the connection between, I don't know, the other gender is really easier.
Yeah.
You know? And because you don't see that person, you feel more comfortable.
So see, let's say it from the very of course, the middle of our discussion, let's say it right in here, that there is no deny over the fact that boys and girls are attracted to each other.
It is because of their nature.
Yeah,
and their...
it is something that exists in their nature, and intuitively they feel so happy when they sit together, when they talk together, when they share their information together.
This is their physical response, you know,
hormones
and so on.
All the hormonal things
and
are
chemicals.
In work, and all the attraction thing that I'm just telling you, and the happiness that is going to be created by just sharing your information with another person of other gender, who's going to have another perspective different from yours,
exactly.
of course, is going to be something interesting for them. But sometimes they don't. Of course, not sometimes. Most of the times, they do not have any idea about the consequences that is going to happen if they go further in their relationship.
And they go, you know, because there is no red line here.
Yeah.
Because you are in a kind of, I don't know, a kind of beach, which there is no horizon. You will go and walk and walk and walk without no end, without no goal. This is the problem here, you know.
Exactly.
You have no goal of these kind of relationships.
So, before we get into another perspective, let's go and listen to something.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So this is Youth Station. Still, we're talking about the unwanted pregnancies and the thing that happens in the future for the girls and, of course, for the child, because in most of the times, boys are not going to share any responsibility for the child that is going to be created.
So from another perspective, let's go through this topic of wanted pregnancy. You know, there are some countries, you know, with somehow warm weather or which, you know, makes this puberty.
You mean that the environment is going to affect the kids,
the children, puberty.
And they get
that region.
Their puberty before the specific age that has been mentioned for them.
Exactly. And I think in this kind of situation, we have to, you know, provide them with these kind of facilities, this kind of information, knowledge, education about this matter of marriage.
Yeah. So even if the youngsters with so young of an age, in the age of 15 or 16, they want and they full-heartedly will to create a life, have this will to create a life, it's okay. And the families actually should talk to them
and protect
them. Also protect them and back them up in the future. Because we have seen it sometimes, even in these young ages, they can start a family and even very much successful families.
Exactly. And let me tell you something. You know, I think this education that family should, you know, teach you is really important, because my mother told me something really interesting that she never told me. She told me that when I gave birth to you, it was like I felt a huge burden on my shoulder.
Yeah.
Suddenly I realized that I have a baby.
Yes, and of course
it
means
a lot.
Yeah, it means a lot.
You know, and you know, I think you have to be ready for this meeting.
Exactly.
And there's responsibility before it happens.
Yeah, so the age does matter, your knowledge matter, and your partner matters a
lot.
Your
family protection.
The families who have single parent are suffering too much of terribles and problems, so we cannot say that the child is going to come out of a, whatever, I don't want just to say it, a one-night stand or just an unwanted relationship, a thing that you never thought is going to go that far away.
Yeah.
The child that is going to be created out of these relationships is a human being, and they need to have a family, but they're not going to have it, and they're going to live a miserable life.
And also, the statistics just tell us the children who are unwanted, you know, they are from unwanted pregnancy or so on, they are going through the addiction, drugs,
that's very true.
Alcohol,
and mental issues, because it is pretty much logical. You can justify the point, because it's very clear when you have no family, when you have no father, no mother, and no
and you
siblings.
Feel always unwanted in your life.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
So it is, I guess, the main responsibility goes for the government, for the educational system, to teach, actually, the children, the girls and the boys, both of them, they need to be aware of their situation, of their relationship, of the friendships they make.
Yeah.
And, of course, they must be aware of the consequences, and they should know that it's not just a relationship.
And again, here I think religion is doing an important job, an important role, which is actually doing well. You know, we see that in Islamic countries, we are not facing that much with these kind of problems.
Yeah, morality is very important because it keeps you in border. And when you have borders, you might never get into terribles.
And also, me as a girl, I have my own special red lines in relationships. I don't avoid them.
Very
I don't
true.
Avoid some day-to-day, I don't know, relation that I have to have, you know, I don't know, university, at work, somewhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Yeah.
The girls are more prone to terribles and dilemmas and problems because, you know, they are more responsible and they can feel the burdens.
And because of that, I have my own special red lines.
Yeah.
And I think every girl should identify and, I don't know, recognize these kind of red lines for themselves.
Should have a should recognize a personality of her own and then understand that she is the one who's going to actually define their relationships. So that's all. The responsibility goes for all the people around us, the parents, the educational
system,
the government. And also for those who teach morality to other people. You know, morality is not just about some special rituals that we do. No, it's more than that. If you have a great connection with your Lord, if you ask Him help in every single step of your life, then everything is going to be pretty much easier.
Yeah, exactly. And just we have to work on our self-control in any field of life.
Yeah, that is very true. And thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you with His never-sleeping eyes.
Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
January 9, 2022. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, addressing a group of citizens from the holy city of Qom. In part of his speech, delivered on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Qom against the then US-backed Pahlavi regime, Ayatollah Khamenei touched on Washington's enmity towards Tehran since the early days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution then referred to a recent document published in the United States, which showed the Americans were after the fall of the Islamic regime through systematic subversive activities. But what was the document exactly, and how did the Americans intend to topple the fledgling republic? The document the Iranian leader referred to is related to a series of 359 documents dating back to the years between 1979 and 1980. Published by the Office of the Historian and Office of the United States Department of State.
Hi, Jimmy Carter. Do solemnly swear.
In one of these documents, then U.S. President Jimmy Carter considered operation against a foreign country important for American national security. Carter ordered propagandistic political and economic operations against the Islamic Republic in order to establish what he called a democratic and responsible regime in Iran. It was based on this order that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was provoked to launch an attack on Iran on September 22, 1980. Carter's order contained contacts with Iranian opposition leaders and concerned influential governments to form a Western-affiliated bloc that would be able to replace the Islamic Republic. The significance of the recently released document is that even Jimmy Carter, who is blamed at home for not being strict enough with Iran, was hell-bent on overthrowing the Islamic Republic. In November 1979, through Executive Order 12170, Carter froze about $8.1 billion in Iranian assets, including bank deposits, gold, and other properties. It also imposed a trade embargo. At the same time, the Americans persuaded ambitious Saddam Hussein to invade Iran, dragging the country into an unwanted, unprovoked war. They imposed an arms embargo on Iran. The fact is, over the past four decades, the U.S. has spared no effort to undermine and, if possible, to topple the Islamic Republic of Iran. As an impeccable foe of the Islamic Revolution, Washington has applied various economic, trade, scientific, and military sanctions against Iran since 1979, while the antagonism towards Tehran has transferred from one administration to the next unrelentingly.
Well, we want to know all the facts. Acting Director McLaughlin said there was no direct connection between Iran and the attacks of September the 11th. We will continue to look and see if the Iranians were involved. I have long expressed my concerns about Iran. After all, it's a totalitarian society.
The second thing that we're going to continue to do is to apply the toughest sanctions and continue to mobilize the international community to make sure that Iran is further and further isolated.
In 2018, then U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, imposing sanctions on Iran. Influenced by his national security advisor John Bolton and Benjamin Netanyahu, two notorious Iran hawks, Trump applied maximum pressure on the Iranian nation with the aim of the so-called regime change. In the heat of the tension between Washington and Tehran, after the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian hero in the fight against terrorism, Trump threatened to strike 52 Iranian cultural sites. In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the revival of the deal. But in practice, he was no different from his predecessor. His administration first began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of unrealistic conditions which Tehran naturally rejected. The aim was to blame Iran, though wrongfully, for not being cooperative, an anti-Iran propaganda.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. But even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
Last but not least, the enmity toward Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy Kenneth Pollack once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran. Whereas Israel is not a party to the NPT or the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, and at the same time the regime is estimated to have up to 400 nuclear warheads, it is Iran and not Israel which is being blamed for threatening the security of the region. In November 2020, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was regarded as the chief of Iran's nuclear program, was assassinated by Israel. The regime has already assassinated a number of Iranian scientists involved in the country's peaceful nuclear program. All in all, the Americans and their partners have never missed a chance to demonize Iran with the ultimate aim of bringing the nation to its knees, but all to no avail.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We have a very special guest speaker for today's program, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, according to the famous, we can say, narrations and the stories, the Satan, which was first an angel, and then it was called the Satan then, he was cast out of the heaven. And then he entered the heaven again in order to deceive Adam and Eve. And especially Adam. So how? Satan was cast out of the heaven, and then he got back to the heaven again in order to deceive Adam. How is it possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, let me correct you. Satan was not an angel at all. Uh-huh. From the beginning, he was a jinn created from fire.
Yes.
And although many people may have the same understanding, because he was among the angels, but it was because of his high rank for mm-hmm. worshiping God for so many years. But his nature was different from that of the angels. He was a jinn.
Okay.
Now, as you rightly mentioned, according to the verses of the Quran, when Iblis, the Satan, was asked by Allah and was commanded by God to prostrate before Adam, all the angels did, but Satan did not do so because of the claim that he said that he is better than Adam. And then he was expelled from what the Quran calls it Al-Jannah. Now, the dear listener who has asked this question, his understanding from this Jannah is the eternal heaven. But the point is that there are a couple of viewpoints regarding this Jannah. Is it the eternal heaven or another place? So although some people have understood this Jannah to be the eternal heaven, but it seems that this is not the case for various reasons. First of all, the eternal heaven is the reward for your good actions. So we cannot claim that Adam was in that heaven before doing any deed. The second reason is that this Jannah is called, according to the Noble Book of Quran, Jannatul Khuld, the eternal heaven, which means that whoever goes into heaven will not go out of it. But we know that, Satan was in this Jannah and then he was cast out. And also Adam and Eve, they were in the same place.
Yes.
And then they were cast out as well. So we cannot claim that it was the eternal heaven. The third argument to reject this claim is that the eternal heaven is not the place for the entrance and for presence of Satan and him being able to deceive the people. So all these points refer to the fact that that Jannah is not the eternal heaven.
Yes.
So either, according to the narrations, it was a garden in the heaven or a garden on this very planet that we are living.
Yes.
So in each case, we can answer to this question that it was not the eternal heaven, it was a garden, either in the heaven or on the earth. It doesn't make any difference. So it was able for Satan to enter this garden, either in heaven or on the earth, and deceive the Satan. This is one point. And the second point is that even if it was in the eternal heaven, we should not think that Satan can deceive human beings by being physically speaking present in that place. Although we rejected that, but we should not think that, Satan is deceiving the human being through being present in a specific place. No. We know that in our time with all these technologies, we have the 3D image, three-dimension image, without physically speaking presence in a place. You can have a kind of connection to other people. So Satan can deceive people without being physically speaking present in that mm-hmm. place.
Yes.
So we should not think that it has been the case that Satan was in the same place as Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
It is a possibility, of mm-hmm. course, but the other possibility is that Satan can deceive Adam and Eve without him being able in that very specific location.
Okay.
But the main answer to this question is that heaven is not the eternal and was not the eternal heaven. It was a garden either on this earth or in the heaven.
That's all right. Is it true that Satan deceived Adam and not Eve, and then Adam deceived Eve or something like that? Or no, both of them were deceived by Satan?
This is what you mentioned. The claim that Satan deceived Eve and Eve deceived Adam
yes.
is what we find in today's Bible.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But the point is that according to the Noble Book of Quran, this is not the case. And Eve should not be blamed for deceiving Adam.
Okay.
Satan deceived both of them simultaneously. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Noble Book of Quran that فَأَذَلَّهُمَا Satan deceived both of them and caused both of them to be cast out of that heaven.
That's right.
So we should not blame Eve for that. Both of them were deceived by the Satan at the same time.
That's right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And Sheikh Karimi, if we know that Adam is considered as a prophet by the Muslims, and is it true at all to say that the prophets were deceived by the Satan? Can a prophet be deceived or not? He has to be immaculate and infallible.
This question is related to the doctrine of Isma or infallibility of the prophets, which is one of the theological discussions among different Islamic denominations, and there are different viewpoints in this regard. But before that, let me refer to one point. We have a group of researchers in our time who believe that it's not that evident that Adam was a prophet. This is not the famous viewpoint, mm-hmm. of course. The famous viewpoint is that Adam was a prophet because in each time we need a prophet, and at least for Eve and for the children, we need a prophet, and Adam should have been the prophet. But the other viewpoint is that, no, we do not have any explicit text from the Quran and the narrations to prove that Adam has been a prophet. So, but given the famous idea that Adam was a prophet, what he committed, was it a sin? And if it is, and if not, isn't it against, his infallibility? Because of the verses of the Quran talk in a way that as if he committed a sin. فَعَصَى آدَمُ رَبَّهُ
yes.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that Adam disobeyed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, before addressing this very question, I need to talk about different viewpoints about the infallibility of the prophets.
Yes.
I'm talking about both Shia and Sunni
yes.
scholars in this regard.
Yeah.
One idea which is mainly accepted by some of the Sunni theologians is that we know that we have two categories of the sins, the major sins and the minor sins. So the first viewpoint is that the prophets are immune and free of only the major sins, but they may commit minor sins.
Mm-hmm.
This is the viewpoint of the majority of Mu'tazila.
Yes.
The second viewpoint, which was held by Abu Ali Jubai, is that they do not commit neither major sins nor minor sins, but only intentionally. But unintentionally, they may commit some sins.
Okay.
Also, he adds that they are infallible from the time of prophethood. This is another question. Are the prophets infallible right just from the beginning of their prophethood or no? Before
yes.
that, from the time of their maturity or even from the time of their birth?
Yes.
This is another question.
Okay.
So this second viewpoint believes that they are immune from major sins and minor sins, but only intentional ones.
Yes.
Unintentionally, because this is another question. If they are infallible, it means that they do not commit any sin unintentionally too.
Mm-hmm.
For example, let me give the example of Prophet Moses alayhi salam and his famous feast.
Yes.
We know that a person was killed
yes.
in that regard, in that event, that person from, the people of Pharaoh. Now, the question is that was it a sin or not?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a sin, was it intentional or unintentional? Some people claim that yes, Moses committed a sin, but it was unintentional, but because he didn't mean to kill that person.
That's right.
There are different explanations
yes.
for that story as well.
Okay.
The third viewpoint is
But at least we could say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's contribution to safeguard even when they were kid can be shown in the Holy Quran. For example, about the Moses keeping a vigil, putting him on the basket in the Nile River, about Prophet Jesus Christ just tucking in the cradle, about Prophet Muhammad, all those things, okay, losing the father. And you know, all in all, we could see that the miraculous aspects of the life of prophets could be seen from when they were children.
That's the point, and that is the famous viewpoint among the Shia theologians. I will come to that, but then we need to explain about all these verses, which, I mean, at the first glance, they may contradict the infallibility of the prophets, like Adam alayhi salam, and this example, like that story of Musa alayhi salam, and a couple of other prophets, for example, the judgment of Prophet Dawood alayhi salam. The next viewpoint is that...
So a prophet can be infallible, but it still does a mistake. You mean this, isn't it?
That's the third viewpoint.
Third viewpoint, okay.
The third viewpoint is that we need to distinguish between the sins and mistakes. Because the question is that to be infallible, does it mean that you're only free from sins or you also are free from any mistake?
That's right.
So as a prophet, is it possible for you to make a mistake? For example, when you're saying your prayer, then instead of saying a four-rak'ah prayer, you say a three-rak'ah prayer.
That's right.
Is it possible for you as a prophet to make such a mistake?
Okay.
This is another question. According to a group of mainly Sunni scholars, the prophets, they do not commit any sin, but they may commit some mistakes unintentionally.
That's right.
Is why they believe that it is possible for the prophet, for example, to make a mistake during his prayer.
Okay.
But... the famous ideas among the Shia scholars and Shia theologians is that the holy prophets and by the same token all the imams of the Ahlul Bayt are immune from any kind of sins,
minor ones,
major ones, intentional or unintentional, and also they are free from any kind of mistake, both before their prophethood and imamate and after that.
Yes.
It doesn't make any difference. The only thing that they may commit what they call it tarke aula, which means that I mean you have two options. One of them is preferred over the other. They may do that, but it is not a sin technically speaking. They have a couple of arguments before going to the story of Prophet Adam alayhi salam. We need to explain the viewpoint of Shia theologians. As I mentioned, this is the famous viewpoint among the Shia scholars. We have some viewpoints as well. But the famous idea is that all the prophets and imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, they do not commit any sin, major sin, minor sin, intentional, unintentional. They do not commit any mistake too. And it doesn't make any difference before the prophethood and imamate or after that.
Yes.
No, they are free from all that.
Yes.
They have at least three arguments that I will share in the following session, and then we'll go to the story of Prophet Adam alayhi salam.
Yes. But the prophets look at the concept of sinning is very much different from the ordinary people.
Sure.
Because they could see the batn, I mean, the inner nature of the sins, and then avoid it. And this makes them different.
Yeah. I mean, this explains the viewpoint of the Shia scholars that why do we claim such a big spectrum for infallibility?
Yes.
Because when you're going to commit a sin and you see the nature of the sin that it is like, for example, eating fire.
Yes.
Are you...
That's right.
Ready to do that? No.
Okay.
And because of the knowledge of the prophets and the imams, they are not ready to commit any sin.
That's right. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن
الآن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he talks about the prophets of God, he says that وَكَانُوا أَقْوَامًا مُسْتَضْعَفِينَ, that this group of the prophets, all of them, they were people who were مُسْتَضْعَف, they were people who were not proud, they lowered themselves to the capacity of the downtrodden, the weak, and the normal people of the society, the lower class of the society. And they lived a very simple life, they lived a life of goodness, a life whereby people of the world, the people that were their followers, were able to relate to that life. And we explained about this in the previous sessions in detail about what this means, and we try to differentiate this with the socialistic, Marxistic way of thinking and also the capitalistic way of thinking. Now we come across this important discussion, and that is that once the governance of the prophets and the divine governance comes in the society, then how is the society? Is there now this dichotomy of mustad'af and mustakbir? Are there the proud and the downtrodden still there? We say that no, there is nothing like that. but there is a ruling class, or there is a ruler and they are the ruled. But we say that this group that are ruled by the community, sorry, they are ruled by the leaders, by an Islamic leader. Each and every one of them have a role in the future of the society, and all of them play in an Islamic system. Every Muslim has a say in the future of the community because he is responsible for Islam and he is responsible for Muslims. This being the case, of course, when it comes to Islamic leadership, we have established the fact that the leader is supposed to be an immaculate, ma'asum person. And that immaculate person is chosen by God. But then, if the people themselves do not decide to follow or wish to have another system of governance, we do not say that the people have done the right thing. That's a wrong thing done by the people. But at the same time, the governance doesn't get established. And this is the unfortunate situation. So therefore, in an Islamic system, the role of the people coming together and wanting a governance is very important.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when you talk about the fact that people have a role in governance, you see, in the different systems that we have in the world, there is a system of representativeship whereby there are certain people who take up the roles, who take up that responsibility or have that covenant to kind of follow up what the people and what the Muslim community and what the Muslims in that governance need to achieve. They take the various decisions, the various steps that are needed in the community and to decide for the future of the community. And in this system, we say that it is not a perfect system because this the role of the general people, the actual people, is not very clear in actually deciding for the future of the community. When I say it's not clear, it means that they do not know in depth and in detail at every moment what is happening in the system of governance. But the problem is that the situation of the world today and the situation of the Muslim society today is that the people are not mature enough to be able to take up these responsibilities. All of them cannot do that. Not every person in the Islamic community is ready or has that capacity to be able to decide for the future of the community. And this is a problem. This is something that makes it difficult for that final and special Islamic system to be applied. Otherwise, in a real Islamic system, any Muslim person is responsible for the whole Muslim community. He can take up a role in establishing, for example, a peace treaty with a certain group of people, on behalf of the Islamic community. That's how much powerful one Muslim person is in an Islamic system, in an ideal Islamic state. But because what we say is that the Muslims are not yet, you can say, mature enough, or the people of the world are not mature enough, we cannot just give this role to the general people of the community. And therefore, there is a system of representativeship whereby there are representatives who take up specific roles, for example, foreign policy, internal affairs, or, you can say, land and trade and, business, and all of these different departments that are there in the government today, each taking specific roles. Otherwise, a mature Islamic system gives much more authority to the different people of the community and the different, the actual Muslims that exist in the society.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, this being said, you will notice that therefore an Islamic system is much more advanced than the systems that exist in the world. The importance that Islam gives to the Muslims, the community at large, is that every person needs to be able to be responsible for the community. Therefore, he needs to work and strengthen himself, even herself, to be able to take up that responsibility and duty for the community, for the society. You can see that. And therefore, this is something amazing if you go and see. It is beyond even what the people of the world today dream in terms of what governance for people looks like. Islam is that form of governance, that form of perfect, system whereby the society, each and every person, to his capacity, is given importance, with regards to the future of the community and the society. And this shows that Islam, when it says that the prophets are not mustakbir, and that the prophets, and that when the system, Islamic system comes, there is no dichotomy between mustakbir and mustadhaf, that they are not downtrodden and they are not proud or overruling people who just want to dictate. When we say that, we really mean it, because Islam is a system, presents a system like that. And inshallah, when that final, wonderful and real Islamic system is established, we will be blessed with the blessings that it comes with and with the greatness that follows for the people. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Elon Musk is the richest man in the world and now owns Twitter. When he acquired it, there were high hopes that he'd be a genuine champion of free speech. There was an expectation in some quarters that the restrictions imposed by the previous incumbents on anti-imperialist and socialist accounts would be removed. But the reality has been somewhat different. So what should we make of the seemingly ambiguous and complex activities of his first few months in charge? We'll be discussing the implications of Elon Musk's Twitter takeover after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
Elon Musk, the world's richest man, bought Twitter last year. Since then, the company has been turned upside down. More than half the staff have left or have been forced out. The company has hemorrhaged money. Musk has claimed to be a champion of free speech and has vowed to make Twitter better by making the algorithms open source and defeating the spam bots. But is Musk a defender of free speech in general, or is it a case of except for Palestine? On the one hand, Musk has acted against censorship in restoring many Twitter accounts. He has annoyed the Zionist Anti-Defamation League. It called for an advertising boycott over the fact that many of the key moderation staff implementing anti-Palestinian censorship in cahoots with the Zionist groups was sacked from Twitter. Musk has also allowed the publication of the so-called Twitter files. Among the many secrets revealed are the industrial-scale demands made by the FBI, CIA, and the Pentagon to remove independent journalists from Twitter and to protect covert propaganda accounts run by the US government. But Musk also seems close to Israel. In 2018, he traveled to Israel and met Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his private residence to discuss how to bring future technology to Israel. In recent weeks, Musk praised the foreign ministry's Twitter account, saying that more countries should use the platform like the Zionist entity does. He also appointed Barry Weiss to report on the Twitter files exposures. Weiss, like Musk, is a purported free speech defender, but being a Zionist, thinks nothing of targeting supporters of Palestine to be cancelled. Early indications are that Musk operates with this double standard too. Take the case of the Jisr Collective, supporters of the liberation of Palestine. Their account was suspended after a pro-Zionist troll falsely claimed the group was a terrorist group actively promoting and celebrating violence against Jews. Musk replied that such posts were not okay. The account was duly suspended. But these details aside, it is not so easy to evade the real pressures of the business environment, in which Zionist agents of influence are much more prominent than supporters of the Palestinians. The involvement of super agent Ari Emanuel in brokering the deal between Musk and Twitter is also notable, especially given his hardline Zionism. Emanuel has appeared at gala fundraisers for the Friends of the IDF organization, which splurges millions on supporting Zionist terror. This is hardly surprising given that his family has a long-standing involvement with Zionist terror. His father, Benjamin, smuggled guns for the Ergin terror gang. Even if Musk wanted to improve Twitter for supporters of Palestine, the objective conditions of the social media and elite business world and their systematic bias towards Zionism will likely make that a losing battle.
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Ibrahim Abul Esed. He's a UK-based Palestinian researcher and an activist, and he holds a master's degree in Middle Eastern studies, specialising in the formation of Palestine since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, what do you make of Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter, and what do you think it will mean for the Palestinian cause?
Well, in one way, it's been very good because this is the thing which the Zionist groups didn't like. He sacked a whole slew of people who were involved in content moderation, and most of what they were doing was making sure that progressive voices weren't heard, especially pro-Palestinian voices. So that was really quite a progressive thing to do in some ways. Mm-hmm. He then restored a whole series of accounts, including a whole right-wing account, famously Donald Trump's account. But at the same time, he's also clearly vulnerable to the idea that supporting Palestinian liberation, is the same as hating Jews. Now, and of course it's not. And he's vulnerable to that kind of double standard that there is about supporting the idea that Palestine should be liberated.
Mm. Ibrahim, I mean, do you think Elon Musk's experience of growing up in apartheid South Africa could have an influence on his attitude towards Israeli apartheid today?
I think in today's day and age, all we have to do is look at his digital footprint on the internet to find out if he has a stated position on this topic. Regardless, we cannot deny the fact that Elon Musk grew up in South Africa at a time where apartheid was rife, whereby the urban layout of a society was dictated by structurally violent policies, segregating people on the basis of their race. And what we have today in occupied Palestine is non-Jews being segregated, essentially Palestinians by mass, purely because of the fact of their religious identity. So we see very similar traits between that in apartheid South Africa and what Israel is doing today in Palestine. We see it through the checkpoint systems. We see it through the ID cards that Palestinians are issued, which is why you have South African activists such as Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, as well as Nelson Mandela, drawing upon these similarities. And with Israel's most recent government coming into power, Benjamin Netanyahu's government, who emphasized that he is going to prioritize and focus his efforts directed towards the Jewish people, we are only going to see more starking similarities between that of South Africa and that of Palestine today. I ask the audience the question, what of the non-Jews, what of the millions of Palestinians living in occupied territory in the West Bank, what of the millions that are living in